This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The title, The Execution of Jesus the Christ. Subtitled, The Medical Cause of Our Lord's Death During His Illegal Crucifixion. Powerful title. Joining me today by phone from Beaumont, Texas, is author Dr. J. Kubala to discuss this book, this work, The Execution of Jesus the Christ. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Good morning.
Pleasure to visit with you. I love the title, and we've visited briefly about it, but why did you choose such a direct title for the book?
I chose the word execution instead of crucifixion because the word crucifixion in today's language does not elicit an emotional response because we don't see crucifixion.
Right.
But we do see executions. Even today, Christians are being executed in Syria. So it carries a powerful image. And of course, I said Jesus the Christ because the word Christ means Messiah. So when you're saying Jesus the Christ, you're acknowledging that you believe that Jesus was the Messiah.
Beautifully put. You have written this book. It's about 150 pages, not really extensive as far as some of the books have written. What was the motivating factor? Why did you decide you wanted to share your knowledge and your ideas about this particular subject matter?
I'm a neurosurgeon, and I've been in practice for 50 years. And involved with medical organizations, including the American Medical Association. In 1968, there was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association written by three doctors at the Mayo Clinic talking about the changes in Jesus's body from his crucifixion. This created quite a stir, as you can imagine, because it was felt by many that this is really not appropriate for a medical journal to be talking about a theological event.
Mm-hmm.
So it got me to thinking, well, what really happened to Jesus's body during those 18 hours from the Last Supper until his death on the cross at Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock? So I started reading books, and in doing so, I was never convinced of the theory that's been thought for 70 years that Jesus died from asphyxiation. Mm-hmm. Now, that theory was proposed by Dr. Barbey in a book called The Doctor at Calvary, published in the 1940s. And he said that with Jesus hanging from the cross in what we call the sagging position, that is, once he was placed on the cross, the body dropped and the arms were at an angle slightly upwards, that he could not exhale.
Right.
That just didn't seem right. So in 2010, I went on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land with our pastor and fellow pilgrims. And then as we were taking a bus ride from Galilee to Jerusalem, which was about a three-hour ride, I gave a talk to the fellow pilgrims about what I knew about the medical causes of Jesus' death. And when we came back, they all told me how impressed they were with the talk. And I said, well, maybe if they're interested, other people might be interested. So that's how I decided I would write this book.
When you began research and study, of course, with your medical background, what interesting facts did you uncover that may not have been generally understood by the public?
I read a book by Dr. Zugibi, who was a forensic pathologist, that was published in 2005 that has not really been widely read. He was a brilliant doctor, and he actually took young, healthy volunteers, put them on a cross with their feet strapped to the shaft of the cross and their arms attached to the crossbar with tension straps.
Mm-hmm.
Straps, and then he actually monitored their breathing, their oxygen saturation, their blood pressure. None of them ever had any trouble breathing whatsoever. And that immediately disproved the theory of asphyxiation. But then he didn't really go into any depth about why Jesus died. He made a few comments. Well, it was probably a combination of some blood loss, some injury to lungs, and exhaustion. And really, the most of his book was about the study of the Shroud of Turin.
Really? That is a side note that I had not heard before. Now, your theory is definitely different. What is your theory, and how did it come about, besides your study that you've just recounted?
If you read the New Testament, you'll find several quotations that say Jesus died by, quote, the loss of his blood, or the shedding of his blood, or by the blood of the cross. Now, the only person that we know that was at the crucifixion was John. The other authors, such as whoever wrote the book of Acts or the book of Hebrews, or even Paul, They weren't at the crucifixion. But they did know people who were there, all the women, and surely they talked to them. And they must have described that Jesus had lost a lot of blood. You can imagine just the blood pouring down over his body. Why else would they have come up with that quotation?
Right.
So then the question comes up, where did all this blood loss come up? Now, if you study the path of his passion, people think about the scourging. This was a flagellation with the whips that had sharp objects such as glass and rocks, and the Roman soldiers would whip the back of his back and drive the sharp objects into the skin and muscles and ligaments, producing a lot of tissue damage. But there are no major arteries that were cut. So where did the blood loss come? Well, as a neurosurgeon, I see scalp injuries, and people know if they've had a child cut their scalp, how profusely the scalp can bleed.
Right.
And it's my feeling that what has not been appreciated all these years is the amount of blood loss that Jesus lost from the scalp. Now, well, I mentioned the Shroud of Turin, and in my book, I don't get into that, although there are many books written about the Shroud. I think the one conclusion we can make after all this study is that no human has ever been able to reproduce the image that's on the Shroud of Turin. And so if you believe in it, and in 1987, the church allowed a study group to study the Shroud, and one of the comments they made was there was a large amount of blood in the head. And interestingly, there's a paper by an Italian anatomist doctor who counted the puncture or laceration marks on the scalp and found 30 and postulated that if it had covered the other side, there would have been at least 50 punctures into Jesus' scalp.
Wow.
Now, when we say the crown of thorns, it's not like we see in artwork where it's like a headband, but in reality, the crown of thorns was more like a cap or a hat. And so you can imagine this tough weed with these sharp thorns stuck in Jesus's head as he's walking from the Praetorium and falling in the streets of Jerusalem as he's making his way to Golgotha. Every time he falls, he's more than likely going to hit his head, and this would start fresh bleeding. Now, certainly, I do note that Jesus had many other injuries. Obviously, when he would fall, he'd bruise his lungs. He'd get a contusion in the lungs. He would bruise the lining of the heart, the pericardium. But I think, and my theory is that the main cause of what we call hypovolemic shock was the blood loss from the crown of thorns. Now, remember, Jesus was crucified on Golgotha, which was a hill just outside the second wall of the city of Jerusalem. I've walked it. It's less than a quarter mile to where the temple stood. Probably Jesus could actually see the top of the temple as he was dying on the cross. But what's to me so prophetic is that as Jesus was dying on Friday, the day of preparation before the Jewish Passover. So as Jesus is on the cross bleeding to death for our sins, the high priest were sacrificing the lambs as an animal sacrifice. So Jesus became our human sacrifice and created a new Passover and abolished the old Passover from the old law.
Another aspect of Section 3, the medical aspects of the crucifixion, why Jesus died so soon, one that's not mentioned or thought of often is the agony of the garden, which was an emotional stress, of course, and then the carrying of the cross itself. Those are other contributing factors, correct?
Yes. I divide the actual medical aspect. Well, first of all, let me just say that my book is divided into three sections. The other doctors that write books will describe the medical changes that took place in Jesus' body as they are developing the story of his passion. I thought it would be better to first educate the reader as to what the background of Jesus' time was, who were the political leaders, who were the religious leaders, such as what's the difference between a Pharisee, Sadducee, Levi, what was Jesus' ministry. And then in Section 2, I talk about the chronology of this last week. How is it that on a Sunday, Jesus was hailed as a king, and then Friday afternoon, be crucified and executed as a common criminal? And so then that leads to the third section, which I devote totally to the medical aspects of dying. And as you said, it starts out with the agony in the garden, and I describe what the emotional stress that took place at that time had the effect on Jesus's body. And then we go into the scourging, which caused a great deal of muscle damage, tissue damage, then the crowning of the thorns, and then finally the nailing to the cross, and then Jesus' death, which even Pilate was surprised how quickly Jesus died. Usually, crucifixion lasted a few days. There are records of it lasting up to 14 days. And Jesus was on the cross, we assume by tradition, about 3 hours. And he obviously died because he was in such a weakened state. And again, not only by the trauma, but the loss of blood, so that his death was a relatively quick death.
You have done this in a very short, precise manner. As a medical doctor, this book is not difficult to read, is it? You have given the historical background. You also have included some sketches of times, places, and events that have taken place during the time of Christ. This book is, would you describe it as something that's different from others out there?
Well, yes. Aside from making my point as to what I think what was the cause of Jesus' death. And again, none of us were there, so I relied heavily on the Bible because the readers are the ones we know about Jesus. So I used that. But then as I studied it, I found a lot of really interesting other facts that the readers might be interested in, such as the study of archaeology, the question of where was Pilate's praetorium where Jesus was condemned to death. Traditionally, we say it was from the Antonia Fortress, which was the outpost where the Romans watched the Jewish people in the Temple Mount. But archaeologists say it was at Herod's temple. So there are just a lot of interesting facts. And I thought, well, if they're interesting to me, I think other people might be interested in them.
Absolutely.
But you also talked about the reaction to my book. The main comments I've had are like quotes. I always thought I knew something about his passion, but I never realized how barbaric it was. And in fact, I've had about the only negative remark, and I don't think it's negative, but people told me the book was so graphic of the pain and suffering Jesus experienced, it grabbed me emotionally, and I couldn't continue reading it. Now, that was not my purpose. In fact, when I submitted my manuscript to Westbow Press, I had to have it reviewed by four different editors. And the first editor reviewed it for content violent in nature. And he made me change a lot of the manuscript. He said, "You're using words that are too graphic of violence." Mm. And I thought to myself, well, this was one of the most violent deaths anyone has experienced. But we did tone it down some.
It's a book that really could be a great resource book for pastors or Bible teachers or just those who are either believers or curious about the events surrounding the resurrection and crucifixion of Christ. You have written this book for what reason? Are you raising money to help your retirement, or what's the purpose of this book financially?
No, I've been blessed in life. And this was a passion of mine. I mentioned earlier that I went to Jerusalem in 2010. Well, I went back in 2015 by myself and walked the city of Jerusalem for several days, just verifying some of the texts and places in the book so that I would not be publishing something that was inaccurate. And what bothered me was how many Christians have left the Holy Land. 10 years ago, there were over 50,000 Christians present in the Holy Land. Today, we're down to less than 20,000. Wow. And what's really sad is that most of the people leaving are the young people. The young people have a hard time finding a job. They have a hard time starting a business because the government makes it very difficult with those different administrative rules and licenses. So the young people are just saying, well, we'll just go somewhere else. This leaves just mostly senior citizens who, at their stage in life, find it difficult to leave and they don't want to start again.
Right.
And it worries me that the tragedy will be that in a few years, we only may have a handful of Christians in the most important place in Christianity, where the land where our Lord was born and died and lived and ministered. So all profits from this book are being given to organizations that support the Christian presence in the Holy Land.
Absolutely outstanding. The title of the book, again, is The Execution of Jesus the Christ, the medical cause of our Lord's death during his illegal crucifixion. And who author who has joined me from South Texas is Dr. Mark J. Kubala. Sir, there are many of my listeners that will want to get a copy of this. How do they do so?
The book is available on Amazon, Borders. We're trying to get it in Lifeway and other organizations. As an author, first-time author, long-time neurosurgeon, it's hard to get a name established. So I'm hoping that as more and more people find out about it, there will be other outlets. But certainly, on Amazon, you just type my name or the name of the book, and it's available, and Borders has it available. As well as Barnes and Nobles.
Exceptional. They can also do a search under your last name, which I will spell for the listeners. It's K-U-B-A-L-A, Kubala. Sir, this is a wonderful book, and I would recommend it for anybody who is a believer or a seeker who wants to know more about the life of Christ. This is wonderfully done. Thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Well, God bless you, and thank you for your ministry also.
Thank you, sir. For Indie Book Publishing West Bow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Beyond the Quest to Become a Physician. And joining me from the middle of the state of Texas near Temple is my author, Dr. Robert E. Burke. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Good morning, Jay. How are you?
Pleasure to visit with you. I am reading a little of your bio and understand you grew up in a very wealthy home. You had all the perks and privileges, and becoming a doctor was a snap. Is that correct, or is there something else I missed?
Well, there may be a few things you missed. Really came from a family of an impoverished family in a small town in northeastern Pennsylvania. My dad worked in manual labor inside of a boiler room, and we had eight boys altogether. I was the fourth, and we, of course, had all those privileges of being upper class and having all educational advantages available to us and resources of a big city.
Right, right. Your mother also had a very challenging upbringing, if I am understanding her background as well.
That's correct, yes. She came from a large family also, seven children in her family, and somewhat abusive family. You know, I hate to stereotype anybody, but, there was a lot of love within that family, but there's also a strict disciplinarian type of behavior, which nowadays would be considered quite abusive.
And in spite of that, you look back on your family upbringing and your mom and dad in particular and have very fond memories of them and their inspiration to you. What was it that motivated you to become a physician?
Well, that's probably the central theme of the entire book. The book is autobiographical, covers my long journey to become a physician and then what I did as a physician afterwards. My mother encouraged me a lot, I think, from a very young age. She used to tell people, you know, ever since Bobby was 4 years old, he wanted to become a doctor. And I'm not sure it was age four because I probably didn't know anything about being a doctor at that age. But it was very early in my life. I think early is correct. You know, who we become is a combination of our genetics, expression of those genes, and then our childhood experiences. So that's the theme I try to cover with tales from my childhood. And, you know, I was very idealistic. I wanted to become a doctor to help people. There was a nice role model in my young childhood, a physician by the name of Dr. Clem from Kingston, Pennsylvania. And I was, we made frequent visits there because with all those boys, there were a lot of injuries, and my mother had a lot of health problems. But it seemed to be just my raison d'etre and my reason for being to become a physician.
Is there anything else in your family that now you have siblings? Did any of those pursue professional careers such as you did?
Well, my oldest brother was the first to go to college on either side of our family ever, and He initially pursued a music career, but then changed over to foreign languages. And then I was the next. There were two other siblings before me, after him. But I was the first to go into healthcare, and actually the only one who did. So, you know, blazing that trail was unlike anything that's ever happened in our family before. And I think, you know, the impoverished background I came from, the educational disadvantages they contributed in large part to the torturous path I took to get there. And it's kind of one of the main driving forces behind my writing the book, is to emphasize the importance of childhood experiences in brain development and how that helps make us who we are. Also, I focus on parenting styles and on what's available in communities and all those resources that contribute to who we become as people. And I try to help the reader envision through different tales I tell about my childhood, my adolescence. You know, some of those are very personal tales, and some of them are even embarrassing. But I think the flip side is that, you know, if others can learn from the life that I lived, I think it would be well worth telling. And there was nobody else in the family that I could model after in terms of, or even to seek advice from in terms of, you know, how do you get into medical school, how do you proceed throughout that career. So I had some missteps. Some of it was naivety. Some of it was not very good decision-making. Some of it was serendipity. Some of it was lack of resources.
But most of it was perseverance. I think that would be the underlying message from your book also, correct?
Correct. And that's in the subtitle, perseverance, because I think that was something I learned primarily from my dad. His strongest character trait was that he would persevere. He would rather work hard around something rather than try to think through the easy way of doing it. But his emphasis was, if you're going to succeed in life, you have to have perseverance. You have to go with the ups and the downs, and you have to stay focused. And I think that helped drive my success.
And he was not formally educated, very similar to my dad. My dad was not a formally educated individual. In fact, I think he dropped out after the eighth grade, similar to what your dad did. But my dad, I consider to be a success. He was he became a minister in his life, founded a couple of three churches, and was very successful at doing that because, again, of perseverance and part of his upbringing. You have mentioned a personal story about Billy. Was that your brother?
Yes, as my the brother was closest to me in age and in activities. He was a year older than me. You know, his story is a tragic one. And, you know, I think in the book I also try to bring in how love and tragedy and serendipity all play a significant role in our lives.
Mm.
And Billy, you know, a difficult story made brief, had some poor peer influences in his life, but eventually he joined the Navy, and after he got out of the Navy, he decided to turn his life around, go to college, and unfortunately, the summer after his discharge from the Navy, he was killed in a car accident. He and his buddy had been out drinking, celebrating 4th of July, and on the way back home, two blocks from our house, his friend fell asleep at the wheel and crashed into a tree.
Wow. Sad story. Sad story.
So we had 13 days of following his slow death in the hospital, and I think that had probably the one, it was probably the most impactful event in my life, other than maybe my marriage.
You also recount an early life experience when Billy and you, I guess, were watching one of the early pioneers of television, Sid Caesar.
Sid Caesar.
and he was Sid Caesar. One of his sketches was swallowing a pill. What happened in that incident?
Well, I think Sid Caesar was trying to sleep, and he was taking sleeping pills. And you know, children tend to mimic what they see. And so my brother went to our parents' medicine cabinet found some pills there, and he wouldn't share any with me, so I went and complained to my mom that Billy wouldn't share, and turned out that he'd swallowed a couple of pills my dad used to use to treat his feet, and so they had to take him to the emergency room and,
wow.
You know, get his stomach emptied and take care of him. So that was one of many childhood events that I kind of discussed as some of my early exposures to medicine.
Although this is autobiographical and sketch in style, you have, because of the stories you have shared, you are hoping to reach a broad audience with what underlying messages?
Well, there are quite a few. I think the audience I'm trying to reach is really threefold. Number one is anybody who wants to become a physician. And in the United States, every year there's about 90,000 folks who start on that journey. And about half of those, about 45,000, end up taking the admission exams. And only about half of those, about 20,000, succeed in getting into medical school. And, of course, not all of those succeed once they're in medical school. So I thought anything I could offer in terms of experience, you know, pitfalls to avoid, insight to what it means to be a physician would be helpful. The second group was parents. And, you know, my parents had a style that, you know, I initially followed as a young parent until I realized that there were better ways to raise children in terms of discipline. And we know that disciplinary measures are generational. You know, someone grows up, they admire their parents and continue to do the kind of things they do. But as a pediatrician, you know, I've spent my entire career studying children and educating parents and about the you know, what we feel are optimal ways to raise children. So I use a lot of these tales to, you know, pretty much present what I wish my parents knew about parenting. Even though, you know, I love them dearly, and I think, you know, without them I wouldn't be the person I am today. But there were things that they copied from their parents and that they understood at the time, you know, before research became available as to what was important, you know. They had some types of discipline that you know, we would really consider being abusive nowadays, but it was all with good intent, I think. So I want to reach parents in terms of those kind of issues, but also to encourage them that what they need to do to help their children succeed is to provide opportunities at different stages in their life. And so one of the unique points of my book is that I weave information about childhood experiences and the neuroscience of brain development with parenting styles.
Beautiful.
And then the third group that I reach out to are those who are already medical students or physicians who are trying to decide which course their career should take. I've had the opportunity of practicing as a solo pediatrician for almost 10 years in an underserved, impoverished area in central Pennsylvania, and I've had the privilege of being part of an academic institution where I was vice chairman of the department, taught medical students and residents, and I can give good insight, I think, to those folks in terms of whether they want to practice in either one of those settings. And also, some of the tales I tell about my experiences with patients, I think will hopefully give them a better understanding of pediatrics and what it means to be somebody's physician.
And I will say this about the book. It is conversational in style. It's not clinical. It's not going to bore you if you're reading this. A lot of the stories are very insightful and also fun to read, as well as some of the, you know, the glaring mistakes that others have made in their life and how it's impacted a family. Thank you again for sharing your story. The title, again, is Beyond the Quest to Become a Physician, and the subtitle is Insightful and Inspirational Tales of Parenting, Perseverance, and Pediatrics. Joining me from Central Texas has been author Robert E. Burke, M.D., Ph.D. Dr. Burke, where can my listeners get a copy of your book?
Jay, first of all, I want to thank you for the interview and for your kind words. I would encourage them to visit my website, It's reburkemd.com. And there's a direct link to where they can purchase the book. They can go to Archway Publishing website. They can go to Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble's, any of the major retailers. I do encourage them to visit my website because in addition to information about the book, I've created blogs. And those blogs address a lot of the themes in my book, and I'm going to have ongoing information for parents and others who are interested in healthcare topics.
Dr. Burke, this book is completed and on the shelves. Is there anything else in the future that you'd like to accomplish?
Oh, yes. I enjoy writing, and I'm going to include this as another occupation during my retirement. I plan on writing children's books and other topics that come to mind.
Exceptional. Just for clarification, listeners, Burke is spelled with an E, B-U-R-K-E. If you're doing a search online, and your local bookseller can also order this book in for you if you can't find it on the shelves. Thank you, Dr. Burke, for joining me today and sharing your story.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Look forward to visiting with you in the future.
Okay, you too. Bye now.
For Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
Listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up, so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Everything for Love. Actually, it could be better described as a motion picture screenplay. And joining me from near the Detroit, Michigan area of the United States is author Victor L. Sabatis. Thank you for joining me today, Victor.
Thank you.
This is an interesting approach because this is not your first book that's been a screenplay. What was it that drove you or motivated you to become a screenwriter?
Well, I've always, ever since I was a kid, I always wanted to be involved with movies. And when I went to film school here in Michigan, I always wanted to be a director, but I just realized that you can't have a good movie without a good script.
Right.
And so I just, you know, I just started working on my first script. You know, it took me like 3.5 years or about three, four years to do my first script. Finally printed it out, and now, you know, I just finished my second, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, well, I've noticed also in the subtitle of your book, or a little of the descriptive, you have mentioned this to be a faith-based story, which again is a little unusual for the movie industry. There is a resurgence of family and faith-based films that is starting to emerge. What was the background for that? Why faith-based?
Well, I'm a faith-based guy, so that's the reason for that. People were telling me, because I've had a lot of people read it, and they're telling me to take out the faith-based. They said it's a superb movie. They just don't like the faith-based elements in it. But I said to them, you know what? It was God that gave me this story, and so it's going to stay in. If a producer decides to, you know, make it into a movie, they can dumb down the faithness of it if that's what they want to do.
Right.
But they're still going to have to leave in parts of it because it's just the way it's designed. You know, Amish country is they're very faith based. You know,
right.
And so that's what needs. There's certain faith things that needs to happen in the movie for the movie to come along, you know?
Right, it makes sense. In fact, there have been a lot of movies that have been produced with that caveat. People or producers have said, that'll never fly, and it's been a runaway success. So I wouldn't go by the naysayers if I was in your shoes. I would kind of let it fall where it is. The back of your book describes it this way. Set in present-day Pittsburgh, Jake Daniels, a ruthless martial arts fighter, thought he had it all. Cars, girls, money, and fame, but it was short-lived. In an unfortunate or unforeseen twist of events, Jake loses his memory, sparking a deep personal journey to discover who he is. And you mentioned the Amish people are part of this the scripting. What is your interaction with them? Have you had personal interaction with people of the Amish community?
Well, not personal interaction. Well, actually, I did have some personal interaction, and it was actually negative and not positive.
Well, congratulations.
But I didn't let that. And actually, that's how I started my story. It was my birthday, and a few years back, 3-4 years back, and my cousin wanted to, you know, go to the Amish country, visit the Amish country. So, okay, for my birthday, we're visiting Amish country. And as we were driving, I got all these, like, images in my head. I haven't even started writing the script yet. It's just all these images about the story. And at that time, I was still working on my first book. And it's like, okay, you know what? I got to put this stuff down before I lose it. So I started writing the second one. And once I couldn't write anymore, I put it to the side and went back and finished my first book. And then once I finished my first book, I came back to finish the second one. So that's how it started.
Right. You're in your writing process. There are many listeners who, you know, fancy themselves as writers or would have that dream of maybe penning something that would last beyond their lifetime. How do you do the story outline? Is it something that you actually outline, or do you work from inspiration and just begin writing? How is it that you develop your characters?
Well, wow, that is such a deep question. To me, a lot of it is just how I see the character, you know, and it's just not me. I mean, there's been like 15, 16 people that have read it and have given me inputs about how they see a certain character. They say, hey, I really see this character having these character traits. So I can't say it's all on my own. There was a lot of people that helped me with the script, you know, at least 16 people that I know off the top of my head. So, yeah.
Well, that's a fascinating way to do it. You have to have a great imagination in order to make those characters distinctive as well. Your main character is Jack Daniels. Who's your secondary character that he interacts with?
Gracie Jacobs.
Gracie Jacobs.
Amish girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess, is Michigan the backdrop for this, or is it another state?
Oh, no. It all happens. Most of it happens in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh. And then, like, the reason I chose Pittsburgh, because I was looking on the map, and I was like, okay, you know, I was like, okay, Jake has to travel for his competitions to different places, okay? And on his way to traveling to one of the competitions, he has to get into an accident in Amish country. So I'm trying to think, like, where would a best place be? And I'm thinking, okay, Pittsburgh. I'm trying to, you know, what other cities are in Pennsylvania? Yes, I forgot right now. Lancaster and stuff like that. So, and then just the way looking on the map, he's like, it seems like this is the best way for them to do is Pittsburgh. And, you know, he's driving to Lancaster, and in the center of it is where there's a huge Amish community. And I looked into it, and Mount Joy, I really like the name Mount Joy. And there's a Amish community there too. So I was like, oh, that would be a good place for him to actually have the accident and meet his love of his life.
Well, I'm imagining an Amish ambulance, and I don't know how fast does that get to the emergency ward. I don't know if you included that in your observations or not. What is the, besides the accident, what is the one thing that a producer, maybe a screen a developer will look at and say, you know, that's a very interesting take. What is it that is in here, if they put it to film, is going to keep the audience engaged?
Well, this is very unique, I think. I mean, we're talking about a martial arts fighter, and actually there's all this illegal activity that goes on behind the scenes of him. He is not, at the beginning of the movie, he's not a likable character. You actually don't get attached to this character because he's so mean. And, well, he loses his memory during the accident. And losing his memory is like when somebody loses their memory, they become a different person. This is how I see it. I don't know if it's scientific, but they become a different person because a lot of the things that we do is based on our memory, based on our friends, peer pressure, and we act certain way because of the people we know. But once you lose your memory, that is all gone. It's like you're starting a fresh new life. So he meets this girl, and he's starting a new life with this Amish community for a while. It's like about a month and a half or so like that. Well, turns out that after a while, the Amish community doesn't really want him there anymore. They want him to leave. Well, certain people want him to leave because of complications of the girl that he loves, and she loves him back, but it's not approved by the community, so he has to leave. He returns back to his life and finds out that he hates who he is. He's been this whole entire time, he's been this guy that is always been he's been a criminal, you know, basically,
right?
And just never got caught. And then basically by the end of the movie, he decides, you know what, I don't care, I hate my life, I'm going to go back to the Amish community, and I'm just going to marry this girl, and I'm going to become Amish and just marry this girl. And that's the end. That's pretty much the story in a nutshell.
Well, that's a twist for sure. There is because of this story, and you mentioned it's faith-based, was there a specific moral to the story that you set out to establish, or was it something that just developed in the storyline itself?
I would say it developed in the storyline. I didn't really, at first when I wrote the story, I didn't really know how the story was going to go. And like I said, I've had a lot of people help me with this, and they actually gave me suggestion. Hey, I think the story should go in this direction. You know, I really see the story doing this or Jake doing that. And so, yeah.
The story set out to be a motion picture screenplay, but it can be read as a novel. Would that be also a good descriptive of what you've done?
Well, I have read, I think, one novel my whole entire life. And the reason why I don't like novels is because there's too many details in a story that does not need to be there. A script is written in a way where you can read, if you're, you know, a standard reader, you know, you're not a fast reader, but you're standard, you can read a script a page a minute. That's how it usually works.
Right.
So you get through the story quick, you know, and it's like scene by scene. Every scene is, you know, interior, exterior, the location and stuff like that, night or day. And it's like you're building the movie in your mind. When people have never read a script before, they kind of, at first it's slow because you feel like you have to read so many details, but it's not. It's like, okay, this is the location, this is where I am, day or night, okay, let's start reading it. And it's just a small narrative, what they're saying, and then basically, you know, each scene has their own little, like, I don't even know exactly how to explain it.
Would it be a nuance of some type, perhaps, that maybe their imagination can pick up on?
Each scene is like, each scene builds up something that leads to the next scene. And you're always engaged. You know what I'm saying? Something happens in that scene that's like, oh, wow. You know, something comes up. Oh, man, how is he going to resolve this? You know, and so the whole entire movie is like that.
That
should be.
That's a good descriptive of what you've written. You also could, I think, make this into maybe a stage play. Has anyone suggested that maybe it could be adapted to stage?
I don't know. Nobody has. To me, in my mind, it's always going to be a movie. Right now, I see it as like a 3.5-hour movie. which people say it's way too long. I mean, you know what? There's so many movies out there that are so long. I think this would be a great 3.5-hour movie. So, you know, Dances with Wolves is one of my inspiration. I think it was like a 3-hour and 20-minute movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was very slow-paced movie, but you were so intrigued the whole entire time. The only thing I didn't like about that movie is, like, what happened to the wolf? I mean, the wolf was like, you got attached to the character of that wolf.
Right.
And then, like, the end of the, you never seen the wolf again after that. So I was like, oh, what happened to that?
Well, the sequel, perhaps. I don't know. Maybe there's a sequel in the works. I don't know if that's going to happen. You have completed this. It took you a while. This is a total of 230 pages, approximately. Is there one scene that you think will stand out as the most exciting thing that you have created?
You know, I mean, I just see the whole thing as one movie. So picking out a scene is just like, it doesn't do it, because the way movies are made is each scene builds up to the next scene.
Right.
So it's like picking out one scene that is like the best scene is like, I don't know how to say it. You know, it's like, it's like drinking a glass of milk through a straw and trying to find the best part of the milk, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand. This is an interesting approach to a wonderful idea. The title, again, is Everything for Love. It is a motion picture screenplay. My author is Victor L. Sabatis. Victor, share with my listeners where they can get a copy of this. There may be a motion picture developer out there that might want to look at your script.
Well, it's all over the internet. You can get it anywhere online, any bookstore. I noticed that all the Christian bookstores have it. Amazon has it. Barnes & Noble has it. So, yeah, anybody could just go online. Just all they have to do is Google Everything for Love and put my last name at the end, Sabatis, and that's it. I mean, you'll see like the first 10 clicks is going to be my book. So.
Fantastic. And let me spell Sabatis for my listeners. S-A-B-A-D-U-S. We'll get a hold of Victor. Do a search online. If you have a local bookseller and can't find the book, they can order it in for you. Again, the title, Everything for Love. Thank you, Victor, for joining me today and sharing your story.
Thank you.
Victor, thanks for joining me today, and best of luck with this. I would love to see this in a theater nearby. Maybe it will pave the way to a multiple, long-lasting career producing and writing scripts for the big screen. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much. You have a good day.
My pleasure. For Westbow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing. Join us again next week at noon Eastern.